I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Diane Ravitch is our guest this hour. Wrote a piece in the New Republic recently with a title, Don't Like Betsy DeVos? Blame the Democrats. The Democratic Party paved the way for the education secretary's efforts to privatize our public schools. Diane writes, 30 years ago, there was a sharp difference between Republicans and Democrats in education. Republicans wanted choice, testing, accountability. Democrats wanted equitable funding for needy districts and highly trained teachers. But in 1989, with the Democrats reeling from three straight presidential losses, the lines began to blur. And she ends her article by saying this: there is already an education agenda that is good for children, good for educators, good for the nation, and good for the Democratic Party. It's called Good Public Schools for Everyone. All Democrats have to do is rediscover it. Diane is now a historian of education, educational policy analyst, research professor. She's at NYU right now, and she is former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education. She's written a number of books about education and has been on our show frequently and always generates a lot of phone calls because a lot of you are in the education profession who listen to this program. So we welcome your phone calls as we carry on our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Diane Ravitch, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me, Kathleen.
And interestingly enough, there was an article about Betsy DeVos and her education in yesterday's New York Times, which will go nicely with our program today, which explains how she really has very, very little understanding of public education and interaction with it. Let's go back. Your article was fascinating. 30 years ago, this sharp difference, and all of a sudden, Democrats changed their tune about education. Why did that happen? How did it happen? Diane.
Well, it was the lure of the idea that everybody would be able to raise their performance by adopting standards and tests. And the Democrats fell for that as much as the Republicans did. Back in 1989, President George H.W. Bush, who's the Bush that I worked for when I was in Washington, brought together all the governors. I think one or two were missing, but otherwise it was the first educational summit of governors ever, and they agreed on a set of six national goals. And they thought that setting the goals was halfway getting there, like saying by the year 2000, we would be number one in the world in math and science, and then everybody else can figure out how to do that. So both the Democrats and Republicans got on board with the idea that if you set targets, that is a way of reaching them. Now, mm-hmm. I agree that it's good to have goals, but unless you're going to fund what's needed to get to those goals, you'll never reach them, and that's exactly what happened. None of the promises made at that summit in 1989 were met by the year 2000, but what happened to the Democratic Party was that it signed on to this idea that having higher standards and harder tests was the way to make everyone equal, and that's ridiculous.
And then the policy, we kept getting all these new programs. You remind us that Ted Kennedy teamed up with George W. Bush for No Child Left Behind. We had President Obama who came up with Race to the Top, that they all had these similar ideas, endorsed charter schools, not real strong supporters of public schools, you know, fired a lot of teachers, closed schools. That happened in Chicago. You remind us of that.
Well, this has been a terrible time these past 20 years for public education. And you know what? I step back and I look at this narrative that we hear all the time that our schools are failing, and it's simply not true. Where there are low-performing schools, there is high levels of racial segregation mm-hmm. and high levels of poverty. And when you put those together, a district that is both highly segregated and very poor, you get terrible test scores, and that's for a lot of social and economic reasons. And the schools may be doing an incredible job, but the kids are coming to school with untreated illnesses, with economic insecurity, home insecurity, no food at home, all these issues that have to do with being very poor, and then the stigma that comes from being both poor and segregated. And these are the issues we should be addressing, but we have simply dropped the agenda that we sort of went towards after Brown versus the Board of Decision, and now it seems as though, particularly with charters and vouchers, segregation is in again. It's okay to have schools that are all black or all white, and charter schools and voucher schools have become the equivalent of reinstating a two-track system, and actually a three-track system. And the I think the best exemplar of that nationally is Milwaukee, where there is a three-track system. And Milwaukee, as you probably know, is one of the lowest-performing cities in the country.
Right.
So if vouchers and charters were the reforms we needed, let's all look to Milwaukee and see that we've tried this now for 20 years and it has not worked.
And a problem in Milwaukee, too, is the number of schools that have been fly-by-night operations where people took the money and ran, literally left the state.
Absolutely. This is a national problem. In Florida, when people propose a charter school, they get a very sizable grant just to plan it. So many people come in, get the planning grant, I forget if it's $150,000, $200,000, $250,000, and they never open a school. And schools open, schools close. They close in the middle of the semester. They close sometimes. They announce that they're opening. They enroll students, and then they don't open at all. And this is taking the place of public schools. Now, why are public schools so important? It's because in this country we decided many years ago, in the early 19th century, that the public school is a public responsibility. It's a civic responsibility. There may be people who decide that they want to homeschool. That's okay. There were people who did that in the early 19th century. There are people who want to send their kids to an elite private school. That's their choice, but they have to pay for it. Or if they want to send them to a religious school, that's their choice. They have to pay for it. But the public school belongs to the public. And we're in the process now under DeVos of demolishing public education and saying it's simply a choice. It's a consumer choice. It's like, do you want to call a taxi or do you want to call Uber or some other service? Mm-hmm. Do you want to have this kind of ice cream or that kind of ice cream? And this is anti-democratic. And I'm not talking big D democratic. I think that everyone should be up in arms about this head-on attack on the very concept of public education. Betsy DeVos doesn't like public education, and she doesn't even understand what its purpose is, which is to create good citizens.
So let's talk about money here. You in your article say support for mandatory testing in charter schools opens fat wallets on Wall Street money guys who like deregulation, testing, big data, and union busting. And then you outline the number of Democratic public officials who have taken, you know, money from these groups to win their election. So there's a money tie. There's always a money tie, isn't there?
Yes, unfortunately, it's true. And there's a professor at the University of Michigan, I think her name is Rebecca Jacobson, who has identified 96 billionaires and millionaires who are funding school privatization. And by privatization, I'm talking about charter schools as well as vouchers. And so on the voucher side, you have people who are very far right-wing. And then on the charter side, you have people who say, well, I'm a liberal, I'm a Democrat, and I believe in charter schools. Well, charter schools are a form of privatization. It is giving public money raised from all taxpayers to entrepreneurs, to people who have an idea. And the number of scandals that have occurred in charter schools is simply astonishing. Now, there may be, someone could say, yes, but I know of a principal who stole money from petty cash. Yes, but I can point out to you charter schools that have stolen millions of dollars. Because there's no oversight and there's no supervision, and this is a terrible thing to do to the people who pay taxes for good schools.
We're going to pause for a moment and get you this little buzz on the phone line that's driving me crazy. So we're going to call you back, get you on a better phone line, and we have many people who are calling in. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Diane Ravitch is our guest. She's at NYU right now, where she is a professor, and she's former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education. We're referencing this hour a piece that she wrote in the New Republic, Don't Like Betsy DeVos, Blame the Democrats. And we have our lines filled now, as I expected we would, so we'll start taking phone calls for her momentarily on the Ideas Network. All right, we have a ton of phone calls for Diane Ravitch, so let's go right to them. And we start with Peter in Baraboo. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thank you so much for taking the call. I am a county supervisor as well as a former school board member here, having served for 6 years. I want to thank Professor Ravitch for her work. It has been most instrumental in helping guide decisions that we have to make here in Wisconsin as public schools. I do wish that our legislature would be more oriented toward recognizing the value of her work and how that can guide our investments. So that's my preamble. I wanted to thank her for all of that work and reinforce the idea that the mythology that public schools are failing is absurd. Public schools have had more and more mandates placed on them, unfunded mandates. Further, public schools are the last bastion for our young people. We in public schools have fed our children more than ever before. We have clothed our children more than ever before. We have had to deal with the failure of families in terms of what happens to children in families of addiction, families that cannot support children properly. Public schools are where all of that care happens, on top of which we then have to educate all of our children and help them become not just intellectually capable, but also citizens of this most important and great country. We have to provide ways in which they can now discern the difference between what people say and what is reality. And those are the great challenges we face. It is not about test scores. It is not about more and more goals. It is about returning to the most fundamental issues of what public education is all about. And I applaud Professor Ravitch so much for the work that she's done. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Peter, for your call. I think we're still trying to, I hope she can listen to a tape of the show. I'm not sure we've reconnected with her at this moment. So we thank you, Peter, and we will give your thoughts to Professor Diane Ravitch as soon as we reconnect with her. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about Betsy DeVos. I don't know how many of you saw the piece in the New York Times yesterday. It's also interesting. We'll put this on our Facebook page in case you missed it. For insight into the Secretary of Education's views, view her education. And it looks at Holland, Michigan, particularly, and Holland Christian School, one of several Western Michigan non-public schools that have helped shape Betsy DeVos's views of elementary and secondary education. So she has very little familiarity with public schools within the country. And I'm sorry that we were trying to reconnect with you. Peter from Baraboo just sung your praises and really sung the praises of public schools. So we'll send you what he said so you can hear it, because it'll make you feel good. I want to pick up on one thing that he said. He talked about public education and the importance of public education and in allowing our children to have to become really good citizens, that there's a role for all of that, and that we need to fund them more fully, and we need to get rid of the focus on test scores, et cetera. A couple questions, but the first one, when you talked about the importance of public education, I really agree with you that it seems to me to be kind of a pillar of democracy in this country. Where did we get this narrative that our schools are failing when most people in the country will say, my school isn't failing?
Okay. It comes, first of all, I wrote two books about this. And I trace the beginning of this
Yeah, I'm sorry, Diane. We just can't hear you at all right now, so I don't know what kind of phone you're on. I'm really sorry about this, but we'll try once again to reconnect with her. Maybe she's on a cell phone. We can't hear very well, so we will get a hold of her. In the meantime, I know that the audience has comments. Diane isn't here right now, but I know that you do, and so we'll just go to some of your comments. 800-486-8655 is the number. Louie in Waukesha. Hi, Louie.
Hi. My comment would be that schools do not fail. It is the communities that send students to the school that have to send students who are prepared for school. When the school receives students who are not prepared to enter and they have to play catch-up, they can't give the curriculum that moves them from 1, 2, 3, and so on. And so if the teacher has too many kids in the class who have to play catch-up, that holds everybody back, and so then in the end, they can't quite make it. And so it holds, there will be students who are quite able to handle it, but there are those students who can't make it because they were not prepared to come to school. So if the politicians who know nothing about education want to help, they should help the communities prepare the students for school and leave the schools alone.
Professor Ravitch, did you hear all of that?
Yes, I did.
Oh, good.
I absolutely agree that the politicians pass laws that are, in many, many cases, ridiculous. They think that if the tests are harder, that's going to make everyone smarter, and it's simply not true. As you keep raising the bar and raising the standards and making the test harder, more and more kids fail. And there are some kids who will, frankly, never pass the test. I mean, in one state, they were insisting that children with brain damage take the same test as children who didn't have brain damage. And one little boy was in hospice care dying, and his mother had to get a letter saying, "He's dying, please leave him alone. We're not taking the test." But this test mania is out of control. And the fact is that the tests are designed to discriminate between the best and the least. So there are always going to be kids at the bottom, and there are always going to be kids at the top. And we will never have 100% proficiency. This was the great hoax of George W. Bush's policy called No Child Left Behind, where he said, by the year 2014, 100% of all children will be proficient in math and English. Well, there was not a single state in the country that met that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an example of setting an impossible goal and then punishing the schools because they didn't meet the impossible goal, and ignoring the real source of low performance in school, which is poverty and all kinds of family issues.
Let's talk a little bit more about segregation. I remember doing an interview with a woman who wrote a great piece for New York Times ProPublica, looking at schools outside of Ferguson, actually, and finding that the greatest predictor of actually higher test scores in students going on to college was whether or not they attended a desegregated school.
That makes sense. There's been a lot of research on this. There's a professor at Berkeley named Rucker Johnson who has done longitudinal studies of the life course of people who went to either segregated or desegregated schools. And for African Americans, the most successful young people and then adults were those who had gone to desegregated schools. They had more likely to go graduate high school, more likely to go to college, more likely to finish college, more likely to lead healthy lives, and more likely to pass these advantages on to their children. That's really important. And as a society, we have almost completely turned away from desegregation as a goal.
Yes, we have. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Thank you, Louis, for your call. Rich, hi.
Hi. I think you just sort of covered my point. I taught post-secondary for 35 years in a rim suburb school. Where President Trump is going to be visiting this week, Waukesha County Technical College. And I told your screener I thought I was grossly oversimplifying because I wanted to sum up Mr. Adich's comments by saying the segregationists have won. I mean, I love the people of the area. I love Wisconsin. I love Milwaukee. The people I taught alongside, the students I had, all very wonderful. But very unlike where my sister lives in the East Bay area of San Francisco, there's not a lot of mixing up of backgrounds in the area. And I'd like your guests to say, no, you're wrong. The segregationists have not won. But that... if I'm interpreting correctly, the assault on public education and promoting vouchers and that sort of thing, in some ways, I think it is sort of a covert or end run around the role of public schools to actually get people of very different backgrounds together, getting to know one another. And the Milwaukee area is a prime example of that. So.
Thanks, Rich. Diane.
Yeah, well, your caller is absolutely right. As a society, we have retreated from the conclusion of Brown versus Board of Education, which is that separate is never equal. And what we have now is a movement through charter schools. Charter schools in the South have become the new white flight academies. They're highly segregated. They're black charter schools. They're white charter schools. So we have to remember that the term school choice was actually demonized for many years, and it had no legitimacy because it was associated with people like Governor George Wallace of Alabama and the segregationists who didn't want to ever relinquish segregation. And their battle cry was school choice. So now we have a Secretary of Education who says she wants school choice. Presumably she knows that school choice is the way to increase segregation, that there will be more schools that are all black, more schools that are all white. And what she has said repeatedly is, as long as parents choose the school, it doesn't really matter. The test scores don't matter. The racial mix doesn't matter. Nothing matters except for school choice. And she was asked in a hearing just recently, well, what about schools that discriminate? What about federal funds going to schools that exclude children of a particular background, let's say race or if they're gay? And she said, well, I'll enforce the laws. What she didn't say is that she considers that a voucher doesn't go to the school, it goes to the family. So a voucher school doesn't have to abide by federal laws. It can keep out gay students, or if they have gay parents, kick them out, not accept them. If they decide that they want an all-white student body, if they want to have a religious test. In the article in the New York Times this week about her own education, referred to her school, and it said that they don't accept anyone unless the students accept the faith of that school. And that's where we're heading, is religious schools that say, if you're not of my religion, you're not allowed here, and yet federal funds will pay for people to go to these highly segregated schools. And we have to mention one other thing, which is that PBS this week, the public broadcasting system, is launching a three-part series called School Inc., which is the DeVos agenda. And it's absolutely shocking. I happen to get a preview of this three-part series. They hold up Chile and Sweden and any place where there's a free market as being exemplars that this is what good education is. Mm-hmm. And the show is paid for by foundations that are all right-wing foundations. It's like the Koch brothers bought 3 hours on PBS.
I'll have to watch that. That starts tomorrow, this week sometime, Diane?
It's going to be this week it's starting, and I don't know what time. It's probably different in every area, but it's a PBS program called School Inc., and it might as well be called the DeVos Agenda for American Education. And it's all the sponsors are right-wing foundations.
Remarkable. I'm wondering how much of the problem here, first of all, you're tampering with something that's such a cornerstone of the American democracy, good public schools. Most of us went to public schools. What, 80 or more than that percent of people, children in this country, go to public schools right now. Are we dealing with politicians who just never set foot in a public school? They send all their kids to private fancy schools, $10,000, $20,000 tuition. Do people not see how absolutely important public school is to the country? I don't quite understand how so many people would allow a public school system to unravel and not know what the outcome would be of letting that happen.
Well, we know what the outcome is. All we have to do is look at Milwaukee, which is where the public schools have been defunded. They end up with the most expensive kids to educate and with less money to do it, having to compete with schools that choose their students. The great hoax of school choice is the belief that parents are choosing the schools, but in fact it's the schools choosing their students. You had asked me earlier about where did this narrative come from that our schools are failing?
Yes.
And I traced it back to a Reagan-era report from 1983 saying there's a rising tide of mediocrity, we're losing the race, other countries are overtaking us, that if a foreign power had declared war on us, it wouldn't be any worse than what our public schools are doing to us. Well, this was all hype. It was in the midst of a deep recession during Reagan's administration, and the schools were blamed for Japan and Germany taking away some of our markets. When the economy rebounded, no one said, oh, gosh, I guess it wasn't the schools after all because our economy's going great. Now, what's particularly pernicious in all of this is that the right wing and even some liberals took up this cry saying our schools are failing us, which is, you know, you'll hear this from Bill Gates. You hear it from different billionaires like Eli Broad in Los Angeles. Our schools are failing. But it's not true. We are the most powerful, most creative, most dynamic country in the world. And a country that has failing schools for the last 30 years, so they claim, cannot have produced this very dynamic culture and economy. So they take all credit away from public schools for trying to educate a citizenry that has far more poverty than what we should tolerate. And they say, well, our hope lies with the private sector. Well, the private sector does not have an obligation to create equal opportunity. The private sector seeks one of two things, either high test scores or profits. And neither of those create equal opportunity of education. Mm.
Thanks so very much, Rich, for your call. Let's go to Jenny in La Crosse. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I have a question. I was wondering, the vouchers take away from the public schools, but yet a physically challenged student could probably not be accepted at a religious school. Why is this? Why are they taking away the support from the public schools that could be used to assist these disability people, and why can't they go and get a voucher also?
Well, generally speaking, the voucher schools, unless they are created specifically for students with disabilities, the voucher schools don't want students with disabilities. The charter schools don't want students with disabilities. And they say, well, we're just not equipped for that. We don't have the staff for it. We don't have the training, et cetera. So public schools can keep the kids with disabilities. Public schools can keep the kids who don't speak English. Public schools, they keep the privatized, the privatizers want to have some public schools around so that they can kick kids out and send them to the public schools. But then the public schools, as I said before, end up with the most expensive to educate kids and with fewer resources. Whenever anybody is advocating for vouchers or charters, they're advocating for taking money away from public schools because there is not an expanding pie. If anything, there's a shrinking pie.
Do you think there's some validity to the, there was a time a few years ago when we were looking at particularly our test scores in science and math and comparing ourselves to other countries, Japan being foremost in my mind right now, where the scores were much, much better, and that there was a concern, a legitimate concern among some thinking, boy, the rest of the world is doing better than our students are, particularly in these all-important areas, and we better do something about it. And that contributed to a move to charters, to vouchers? What do you think?
Well, I think it's in my book, Reign of Error, which was my last book. It came out in 2013. I have a chapter on the international test scores and why they are absolutely meaningless. There is no connection whatever between the scores of a 15-year-old and the economy of a country. People think, oh, gee, we used to be number one. The first time that an international test was given, which was in 1964, there were 12 countries who took the test. We came in last. We have never been number one on the international test. Typically, it's been Japan, South Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong. This is a particular approach to education. It's very popular in the East Asian countries, and that is the test is everything. Prepare for the test or your life is ruined. If you don't pass the test, your life is ruined. We don't do that in this country. We recognize that kids come to school with different interests, different skills, particularly when they take international tests, they know it doesn't count for anything. And so our kids just don't do their best because, you know, when people say, does it count? The answer is no, it doesn't count. And so we have led the world and had mediocre international test scores. And countries that have higher scores than us, like Japan's economy has been stagnating. So what have the test scores got to do with it? Absolutely nothing. And yet what we should be looking at is not test scores. We should be looking at what percent of our kids have access to high-quality preschool. What percent of our kids are healthy? What percent of our kids come to school well-fed? What percent of our kids have access to good medical care? That's what determines test scores. And I think that the fetish about test scores has misled us. We have had actually a great public education system because we recognize that some children will be incredible as performers. Mm-hmm. They will be, you know, brilliantly talented on the stage. Others will be singularly focused on science and robotics. Some are fantastic athletes. We recognize that children are different, and their talents are different, and they develop at different rates. And it's a much more... We don't have a single school system. We have like 14,000 school systems, and they're all different.
Thanks, Jenny, for your call. Alec in Whitewater. Hello, Alec.
Hi. I just had a question for the caller. I was curious, as there's this idea that our public schools are failing. If that's the case, then what would be a single justification for cutting funding or pushing funding towards private schools? It just doesn't really seem to make any sense to me.
Well, first of all, our schools are not failing. They do. If you look at the schools in where the community is healthy, our schools do it very, very well indeed. If you look to schools where the community is in desperate trouble, the schools are in desperate trouble, and they're doing the best they can. If the push for privatization, for private schools, for vouchers, for charter schools, is ridiculous because we now have evidence. We know, for example, with vouchers, that kids actually lose ground, that if they transfer from a public school to a voucher school, their scores go down. And with charters, it doesn't make any difference at all. You know, there's some good charters, there's some bad charters. It does, but if you're looking for a strategy to improve American education, it's not by defunding public schools and putting the money into private entrepreneur schools that are looking to make a buck off public education, are sending kids to religious schools where, in most cases, the teachers are not certified and don't see teaching as a career.
Hmm. Let's talk about the governor of Virginia, Governor Terry McAuliffe, and the governor of Montana, Governor Steve Bullock. You mentioned them in this article. The governor of Montana insisting charters employ certified teachers, allow them to unionize, and fall under the control of local districts. Governor Terry McAuliffe vetoed a bill to expand charters back in March, and Bullock said, "I continue to firmly believe that our public education system is the great equalizer." What prompted them to do what they did and have people in their states endorse their ideas on education?
Well, it's interesting. In Virginia right now, Terry McAuliffe is term limited out, and there's a Democratic primary that's going to be held tomorrow. And the two men who are in the race are both saying, "I'm not for charters." No, he really is for charters. "I'm not for charters." So it's become an issue
really
to say he's the one who's really for charters, I'm not. And they're both exchanging these kinds of charges against one another. So I find that very heartening. The question for me is not why is the governor of Virginia and the governor of Montana pro-public education. The question for me is why aren't there 47 governors who are pro-public education? I run an organization called the Network for Public Education. We had to search high and low to find a governor who would proudly say, our public schools are great public schools and we're going to make them better. I mean, wherever they need the resources, we will provide them. Honestly, most of the governors today are like Mike Pence in Indiana, who's been replaced by someone just like him, Eric Holcomb, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Greg Abbott in Texas. I mean, the Rick Scott in Florida. All of these red state governors want to get rid of public schools and replace them with charters and vouchers. That's the majority of governors. And even among Democrats, as I pointed out in the article we're talking about, we have Andrew Cuomo in New York, who took millions of dollars from hedge fund managers to become a charter champion. We have the governor of Connecticut, a blue state, who took millions of dollars from hedge fund managers to become a charter champion. Jerry Brown opened two charter schools in California, and he refused even to veto legislation to stop for-profit charters, which have been a mighty scam. So right now, when I pointed out Governor Bullock in Montana and Governor McAuliffe in Virginia, there might be one or two other governors that I could say these are people who understand the importance of public education. But frankly, it is shocking that public education right now hangs in the balance and that we have a woman like Betsy DeVos, who doesn't like public education, who doesn't believe in it, as our Secretary of Education. It's absolutely shocking. She just announced yesterday she's appointing someone from the Walton Foundation, which is one of the most right-wing anti-public school organizations, as her assistant secretary in charge of policy. So that's a very crucial job in the Department of Education, and we're going to see the Department of Education under this administration actively fighting to privatize our public schools and our public dollars.
Alec, thanks for the call. Mary in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello.
Yes, Mary, go ahead.
Well, the million-dollar question here is, how do we, the not-so-rich people, fix this?
How do we fix public schools?
How do you fix the whole problem? How do you fix...
Yeah, how we fix the whole problem is this. The only way, I mean, first of all, join the Network for Public Education. We're an organization now of almost 500,000 people, and we spend all of our time trying to urge people, vote, vote, vote. I mean, I can't believe that the people of Wisconsin want to get rid of public schools. I mean, Wisconsin's always had a great public school system. I can't believe the people of Michigan want to get rid of public schools. I can't believe the people of Indiana want to get... I mean, the Midwest has gone completely red, and people have to vote. And what I've always have said is they have the money, but we have the numbers. And if people actually woke up and understood what's going on around them, and that they are at risk of losing public education, not just in the inner city, but in suburbs and in rural communities. And there are even now people in the privatization movement who want to move into rural communities. And the one thing that has stopped Texas, for instance, which is a red state, vouchers have been stopped now for 3 years in a row because of a coalition between urban Democrats and rural Republicans, because the rural Republicans don't want charter schools and don't want vouchers, because they understand that their community's public school is the hub of their community.
Yes,
the lifeblood
of
the community.
Yes. Right.
And so it becomes important to create these coalitions involving whoever is interested in saving their public schools, and vote and turn out some of, you know, turn out people like Scott Walker. Scott Walker is just a kind of a pale shadow of Betsy DeVos. He's not a billionaire. She's worth $5 billion. He's not.
Thanks, Mary, very much for your call. Isaac in Flatville. Hi, Isaac.
Hi there. This might be a little bit of a stretch, but I just want to comment. You said test scores don't really matter. I went to school in Zion-Bitton down in Illinois, just right under Wisconsin there, and they scared like all the classes that if you don't take your tests and you don't go to college, you're going to fail in life. So they never taught us how to do like a checkbook or anything. And so I eventually went to college and ended up dropping out because it wasn't for me. So is there any, I wanted to know your opinion, if they should take kids like me who aren't set to be four-year college students, I became a truck driver, and set them on the correct course instead of making me take tests that are not useful for me. And I took calculus when I was a junior, and I never use any of it anymore. So that was my question.
Well, I think it's a good question because, as I was saying before, the one thing about the test is they're standardized, and there's an effort to standardize everybody, and people are not standard. We're not standard people. You're very different from me. We're both very different from Kathleen. Our children are, you know, even our own children are different from one another, and I think that good education is one that takes into account the interest and the needs of individual children. You should have not been judged by test scores. They're called college-ready test scores or college and career-ready. And that's what's been foisted onto the country with the Common Core, which is that everyone has to be college and career-ready. And they're bringing the testing down not only to kindergarten, but to pre-kindergarten. And this is frankly sick. I think that you would have been better off having an education in which you had choices about career and technical education, in which you could decide what was most in your interest. And you might have decided that you wanted to go to community college. You might decide now you want to go to community college. But you shouldn't be marked as a failure because of these stupid standardized tests. And I think that the only reason the tests have value is when they provide information to the teacher to help her become or him become a better teacher by saying, this is where we can help the student. Today, kids across the country are taking tests in the spring and the results come back in August or September, and they don't even have the same teacher anymore, and they're not allowed to discuss the questions. They're not allowed to say, this is what you got right or wrong. So we learn absolutely nothing about the children, and the testing industry would like to keep it that way because this is a multi-billion dollar business for them, and they keep their questions secret, and it doesn't help students. They don't find out what they need to know. Their teachers don't find out what they need to know. And what I'm saying is the test, if it's not a diagnostic tool, it's like going to the doctor and have him saying, I'll get back to you in 6 months or a year. And when I get back to you, I'm not going to tell you what's wrong with you anyway. So the whole testing thing is out of control. And I think that our schools have to be much more focused on what's in the best interest of the children, recognizing that the job of the school is not to standardize children. Mm-hmm.
Diane, give us an idea. I've wondered about this. When you look at charter schools and voucher schools, and you probably have a national view of all of this, do most of those schools not require teachers to be certified to go through education training? What are the standards?
It varies from state to state. It's based on state law. In some states, charter schools and voucher schools do not have to have certified teachers. And in states where teachers are certified, in the charters and voucher schools, especially in the charter schools, they turn over very rapidly. Charter schools are well known for high teacher turnover. So in some schools, I mean, like just yesterday, there was a charter chain in New York City was awarded a prize by Eli Broad's the Billionaire Foundation. So he gave a prize of $250,000 to a chain that's known, first of all, for harsh discipline, secondly, for not accepting children with disabilities, third, for kicking out kids who get low test scores, and for high teacher attrition, high teacher turnover. So when you have high student turnover and high teacher turnover, it's a sign of a very bad school. I mean, this is what's so frustrating to me is that the American people don't understand what's been going on right under their noses, which is the agenda that Betsy DeVos talks about publicly, which is, doesn't matter about the quality of the school. If you chose it, good luck to you.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Diane Ravitch is our guest this hour. She was Assistant Secretary of Education in the President George Herbert Walker Bush administration. She's now a historian of education, educational policy analyst, and research professor at New York University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Please leave your comments there. We love to hear the ongoing discussion. And we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Returning to phone calls, Colin in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for letting me talk or be on air. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely.
My biggest point, I am a teacher in central Wisconsin, and I love teaching. I would do nothing else but be a teacher. But this constant comparison, I guess, just drives me crazy. And I'm wondering if there's ever a study done. Because I have a limited experience in Peru, and then I was in the Peace Corps in Thailand. And classroom here in central Wisconsin, every test score counts. But in Thailand, they didn't have a special ed department. And those kids either didn't go to school or they were just kind of in the room somewhere. But their scores, their work didn't count. So we're constantly in this comparison, but are there other nations? I mean, we're comparing apples and oranges. And so I guess it's frustrating when people harp on we're ranked whatever in the world, but not everybody in the world runs their education system the same way we do. And so I guess it bothers me just in general with comparisons of local, state, and even nationwide, but let alone worldwide when we don't do the same system.
And Colin, what do you teach? What grade?
I teach fifth grade, but I'm in a K-12 building, so I get to dabble and help out in all aspects. So it's just wonderful.
Oh, it's always good to hear from happy teachers. Diane?
Well, I think that all of these comparisons, whether it's state or national or international, are all based on the same flawed instrument, the standardized test. And the scores will be highest where there's the most affluence. And so wherever you have communities where there's little or no poverty, you'll have the highest test scores. And they will also be higher in nations that prize testing above all else. And so you'll get the East Asian nations, which put so much pressure on kids and to get the scores because your whole life depends on your test score on this standardized test. They get higher scores. None of this matters. I mean, what matters in a society is, are people kind to one another? Do they have, are they brought up to have character? Do they care about their community? Do they care about their country? Do they take care, do they help other people besides themselves and their own family? All these things about character matter so much more than standardized tests. And there's a book that's coming out in, I don't know, a few months from the University of Chicago Press, and it's called The Testing Charade. It's written by a professor at Harvard who's one of the leading national experts on testing, and he said, this is all a great pretense. The tests are so flawed, we should not be judging people by standardized test scores. And what the reason we're focused so much on test scores is because we don't trust teachers. I think we're the only country that I want to be compared to is Finland, because in Finland they have no standardized tests, and they have highly skilled teachers, and they trust their teachers to make judgments about how their kids are doing and what's in their best interest. And when you say, well, how do you compare? Well, they take the international test. They're the highest scoring country in Europe, but they laugh at the scores because they don't prepare kids to take tests, and they don't take standardized tests in their schools.
Colin, thanks so much for your call. Trissa in Madison, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to comment. One of my fears with this whole thing is that over time, if their agenda succeeds and you have these voucher schools come in and we're paying for low-income people to go into these voucher schools, and then eventually the government says, well, people are entitled to these vouchers and they don't really deserve that, so we're going to pull the funding from that. There won't be vouchers anymore. You want your kids to go to these schools, you'll have to pay out of pocket, and then there won't be any fallback for these children without the public schools that we've relied on for all these years. So I guess that's my comment, and I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Okay, so my view, which is like the macro view, is that all of this reliance on vouchers and charters and privatization and cyber learning and all of that stuff, it's all a dodge to avoid paying to have the best public schools in the world. And the taxes should be much higher on someone like Betsy DeVos, who's worth $5 billion. The 1% is getting away with murder. And this is one of the reasons, maybe the main reason, why they are underwriting so much of the privatization, because they're not willing to pay what it costs to really, really provide great schools, whatever community it is. Instead, they say, well, let's have vouchers and charters, and at the same time, we can cut the budget. I mean, this is Trump's budget for education is a perfect example of this. He plans to eliminate entire programs, for example, like no more federal support for the Special Olympics for children with disabilities, a saving of a big $10 million out of a multi-billion dollar budget. And at the same time, he wants to take, while he's cutting, $13 billion from public schools, he wants to divert over $1 billion for choice, for vouchers and charters. So this is a way to save money and to avoid facing up to the fact that public schools need to be properly funded, and where there are great needs, great resources are needed.
Well, Diane Ravitch, thank you very much, as always, for being with us. I enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I always enjoy talking to people in Wisconsin because there is so much that's needed to turn your state around.
Thanks. Diane Ravitch, our guest, she was, as we've been saying, the Assistant Secretary of Education in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. She's a historian of education, educational policy analyst, research professor, and she's now at New York University. More comments, put them on our Facebook page. If we couldn't get to you, we'd like to read them when we're off the air, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're going to be with you tomorrow. And as I said earlier, I'm not sure what we're going to do, because here's why we don't know exactly. We know that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is going to be delivering his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee at 1:30. We're not sure if NPR is going to do a lead-up to that. I'm sure they have to say something. They just can't say, here's the testimony. But I'm not sure how long that will be, so it's questionable when we'll be on the air tomorrow. That's all I can say. So we hope to be here for part of the hour. We'll be talking about why a little bit of paternalism in medicine might be a good thing, and that should come up hour number two. Thanks so much to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour, and to Colleen for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And Thanks for all of your participation.